Hi, this is Derek Jensen with the Progressive Radio Network and Resistance Radio. My guest today is Stephanie McMillan. Hi, Stephanie.
Hey, how are you doing, Derek?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you.
Good. So, Stephanie is an activist, author, cartoonist, and an all-around great thinker. And so, Stephanie, my first two questions, I guess, are what is capitalism and what's wrong with capitalism?
Well, capitalism is a form of class society which has come to dominate the entire world in one global system where the whole of social production is done for the benefit of only a few. Class divisions have existed for the past 10,000 years, but what makes capitalism different from previous forms is the way that wealth is accumulated, which is through the exploitation of labor in the process of the production of commodities. Workers are not paid the full value of their labor. They produce more value than they receive as wages. And that extra labor power, which is stolen by the capitalist and is called surplus value, is embodied in the commodities and realized as profit when those are sold and reinvested as new capital.
Wait, can we stop for a second?
Sure.
And just give an example of that. It's like, and just make it up. It's like, because I remember when I first encountered the surplus value thing, it really blew me away and helped me understand capitalism, but there were some examples that helped. So somebody's working for $10 an hour, $5, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, you're working for $10 an hour and you're making boxes of frozen waffles. You're working in a factory. And you're producing in 1 hour, well, the amount that you're paid is a wage that corresponds to the working day. So you're paid a certain amount, $80 a day. And you produce $80 worth of waffles in an hour, let's say. So the whole rest of the day, you're producing waffles for free. That the value of those waffles belong to the capitalist. It doesn't belong to you who made them. So every hour, you're producing $80 more of waffles times 7, which my math is bad, but whatever that is, you've produced that much surplus value for the capitalist.
And the argument is that the capitalists deserve that because they're taking a risk with their money, right?
Yeah, and because they own the factory. But the factory itself was made through the same process, and so it's congealed stolen labor from workers as well.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, no problem. The capitalists do have the most weapons usually, and they take this stuff in the beginning. So that's why they claim to own it. They conquer it. That's the initial, the first part of capitalism is called primary accumulation, and that's basically going out to somewhere and stealing money and resources and enslaving people. So it's basically, it begins as conquering, and then once it's owned, they claim to have a right to it. So anyway, capitalism involves the domination of this class over the working class, and it also involves the resistance of workers to that domination in a matrix of social relations that are manifested in economic, political, and ideological fields. So that's class struggle, and it shapes our everyday lives, everything we do. It shapes our taste in music, who we care about, what we wear, and eating that frozen waffle that's been microwaved and produced in that factory is a manifestation of class struggle.
So can you give more examples? Like you said, music. I'm understanding you theoretically, but can you ground me here too? Like what does that mean that it influences every bit of our daily lives?
Well, let's say you're standing in line to buy an iPod, the latest iPod. What makes you want that latest iPod? It's ideological domination that you need it. It's also the way that capitalism has integrated that into your life as something that you really feel like you do need, that might be an integral part of how you carry on your existence. So all these things that are supposedly things we need, like the car, we need the car to get to work. That was a very deliberate plan to sell more cars. You know, the whole way that the highways are structured, the way cities are structured, the way we don't live near where we work, you know, that's to sell cars. So all these, the whole society, the way that it exists, has been shaped by the economic system that we live under, and in its interest, in the interests of the class that dominates that system.
Okay, good.
So, under capitalism, and I think we both see it this way, instead of people using machines, like a farmer using a hoe, machines are using people. And machines are the embodiment of previous labor power, like I mentioned before, which means that workers were exploited during their production. And now these machines, which are now called fixed capital, workers have become the appendage of them. And workers, the wages are now considered variable capital. So a worker is basically just stuck to the machine, an appendage of the machine. It has to work at the pace of the machine. The worker has no choice about how to conduct their job or conduct production. They're just an attachment. So that's what alienation means in that sense.
Well, it reminds me of this line by Frederick Winslow Taylor about 100 and some years ago about, there's this really chilling line about, in the past, the man was first, sorry about the sexism, in the future, the system shall be first. And it's always cracked me up, like when, cracked me up is the wrong phrase, but it's always chilled me, you know, it's always really struck me that, what's the point? You know, it's like when they talk about, like when there's NAFTA or any of these other so-called free trade agreements, they can talk, or when they talk about environmental destruction, it's like, who, you know, it's a choice between destroying your water supply or maintaining this current use of energy, for example. And they always choose the current use of energy, even when they're talking about something like poisoning your water supply. And that just seems completely nuts to me. I don't understand how we can have rational discussions about that particular choice when we're talking about substances needed to survive.
That's because humans are not in control of capital. The only reason that production occurs under capitalism at all is to produce more capital, for capital to reproduce itself. It's not concerned with what's useful or helpful or good, except insofar a little bit as the commodities have to have at least some use value for anybody to be motivated to buy them. But otherwise, capital's taken on a life of its own as a self-perpetuating, ever-expanding social machine. And the reason that it can't stop expanding is because of competition among individual capitalists. So they have no choice about this. Unless they keep cutting their costs, increase their technological efficiency, and producing on an ever larger scale, and also by cutting wages, that's their main goal, they'll be swallowed up by bigger and more ruthless capitalists. So it's a matter of their own survival.
And this is what we hear all the time, is that, oh, this community has to give tax breaks to Walmart because they're in competition with some other community for this. And so it's this, the phrase we always hear is this constant race to the bottom.
Yeah, exactly.
And it happens internationally, too, with what's the, you know, where it used to be that China was the cheapest labor, and then it was, what, Vietnam, and now it's Bangladesh. I don't know what the countries are, but they keep finding a place, yet another place where they can drive the wages down further.
That's absolutely their, yeah, that's their imperative. They have to. And prison labor is another one.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Prison labor is another one.
Right.
Yeah. Another reason that it has to expand and continuously expand even against all rational human interests and the interests of a living world is that most of the surplus value generated in the process of production isn't consumed because workers can't be paid enough as a whole to consume everything they produce, or there wouldn't be any profit. So instead, they reinvest it as new capital. So that increases the rate of production overall, too. And that's another part of the cycle that just makes it continuously built upon a larger base of capital than it started with. So the rate of expansion is enormous. And like you've said,
Go ahead.
You know, you said a million times that there can't be infinite growth on a finite planet, and that is absolutely true, but infinite growth is exactly what capital requires and insists upon, and it will get it unless we stop it or unless it uses up and kills all life in the planet on the process. And even the capitalists can't stop that. They're not in control of it. And that's why it's so evil. You know, that was the second part of your question is, the capitalists aren't stupid, and they know they're on a suicide mission, but they can't do anything about it. Because capital itself has such dominance over society that under its logic, like you're saying, I mean, that it makes economic sense for farmers in New Mexico, where there's a severe drought, to sell water to fracking companies, even though they know it's going to ruin their own farms and their drinking water, but they need to pay their bills right now. And maximum profit in the immediate right now is all that capitalism understands. And it doesn't care about the cost to the rest of the world. It doesn't care about the cost to everyone involved. It's relentless and voracious and never satisfied. And it must and will turn anything and everything else into itself. And like Dick Cheney said, and he's a very loyal representative of capital, he said this is non-negotiable. It's not that he's non-negotiating our lifestyle, like he said, but but capitalist growth is non-negotiable. It forces everyone and everything into its matrix, and it kills millions of people through war and deprivation. It exterminates the natural world and turns it into dead objects for sale, and it creates suffering and misery wherever it touches. And again, like you've written about a lot, if we don't stop it, it's going to exterminate life itself.
And there's a couple directions I want to go with this. One of them is, so I'll tell you the two directions. The first direction is I want to go back to the crisis of overproduction stuff for a second.
Uh-huh.
And then after that, I want to, you know, we talk about all the bad things it's doing, but I'm wondering if we can talk about some version of, you know, Mumford's Magnificent Bribe. You know, how do people go along with it then? So let's back up. First, the crisis of overproduction, because you mentioned that, and the idea is that, like you said, if the workers can't buy all, if you're not paying workers the full value of what they're making, then they're actually producing more than the workers can buy. And when I first learned about that, that finally helped me understand, and of course there's many other reasons for it too, but that finally helped me understand why the U.S. military has to stay huge.
Mm-hmm.
Because those aren't consumer products. And so you're actually paying somebody $10 an hour to build a missile that is set up specifically to be destroyed. It's not actually to be purchased. And so that's
exactly
one of the safety valves for overproduction. Is that right?
It is, but they are making us consume it in a way because they make people pay for it through their taxes. So the money that's actually going into the production is, it's kind of like an enforced consuming rather than, because they know we won't buy it on our own. We think we won't buy enough. So they're kind of forcing it. And also, yeah, that's why they print money also to keep things going because there's not enough of it coming from us. And yeah, there's this requirement to make stuff and throw it away, waste it, create chaos so that there's always new innovation.
Well, I can, given everything we've said so far, it sounds like capitalism is not a very, it's certainly not a sustainable system, and it's certainly not a just system. But apart from naked force, why do people go along with it?
Well, it starts with force, with incredible violence. You know, as we've seen with how nations are conquered, how lands are conquered, how people are conquered, it's still going on today. they won't even let the most isolated people live in the far reaches of a forest unmolested. They have to go out there and incorporate them. And the way that they started was incredibly violent. The first thing they do is they'll go to a country where people are still working on the land, and they'll find a bunch of ways to get people off the land. And if they don't use force, they use a lot of other ways, like dumping commodities that are cheaper than peasants can produce, so they can't sell their goods on the market, and then they lose their land. Like, they have a bunch of techniques for this. Or they'll say, oh, your animals have some disease that might spread to our country, so we're going to kill them all. And that destroys the peasant economy. And they'll find a way to separate people from their means of subsistence and force them into a capitalist system. And then the people have to go to the cities and look for work. And when they're already metabolized and after a couple of generations and it seems normal, then there's also ideological domination. That's where that comes in. The whole idea of private property, why do we think that's okay? That's ideological domination. This idea has been incorporated as something that's okay and rational and normal to have private property for some people to control how everybody else lives. And then there's also politics, where they've set up all these institutions and laws, and the idea that you're supposed to be compliant with them, that they're fair. You know, freedom means that you can accumulate as much as you want. Freedom means that you can buy as much as you want. So brainwashing, basically. And those who don't comply, they have force to back it up.
So I want to go back to the driving people off your land, and can you tell the story that you've told me before about there's a friend of yours from Bangladesh who, not very long ago, used to be able to fish?
Yeah, well, it's a few decades now, but when he was a kid, his mom used to say, it's time for lunch, so can you go out and get a fish? And they could easily go out, and there were streams and rivers everywhere and ponds, and it would take like a minute to go out and pick up a fish because there were so many all over the place. And in fact, in that time, 70% of the food that was eaten by people in Bangladesh was forage. It was just right there outside. Like, you didn't have to do anything to get it except go out there and get it. But now, because of the domination of Bangladesh by international capital and the relentless drive to transform their way of life into something that's profitable for international capital, the rivers have become poisoned by pesticides and fertilizers that have been foisted onto the peasantry, and now there are no fish in the rivers at all left. So they have to import fish from other parts of the world, and they cost something like $50 for a good-sized fish that used to be free to catch outside. So people have, you know, it's a constant degradation of life. You know, people having to struggle harder and harder even to stay alive. And then a lot of people now have to send one of their children abroad to work and send money home because there's not a way to survive anymore in that country alone, you know, without somebody sending back some income.
I think a lot about a letter that was written by a southern pro-slavery philosopher in the 1830s to his northern abolitionist buddy, in which he laid out the conditions under which it was in the capitalist's best interest to own slaves versus to not own slaves. And it was really simple. It was, if you have a lot of land and not many people on the land, then that means that the people have access to the land, which means they have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they have access to self-sufficiency, which means the only way you can get them to go to work for you is by physically enslaving them. Mm-hmm. And on the other hand, if you have a lot of people on not much land, or if you can convince everybody that the land is actually owned by the rich people, then they don't have access to land, which means they don't have access to food, clothing, and shelter, which means they don't have access to self-sufficiency, which means they have to go to work for you for whatever pittance you want to pay them.
Exactly.
That always seemed the what happens at the frontier of capitalism.
Mm-hmm. It's the first step, is to deprive people of their means of subsistence, force them to be dependent on a job.
Which has always suggested to me that wild food stocks, like salmon, like the fish in those streams in Bangladesh, can't survive the logic of capitalism, because why would I go to Safeway to buy food if I can just go out the back door? And once they've made you dependent for food, that means you're going to be dependent upon the wage economy, which means you're going to have to dive into it.
Right, right. And I think that's why climate change isn't such a problem for capitalism at all, because when there's less water available, when the air is polluted, when the food is poisoned, the prices of everything go up, and that's fine for capitalists. Why would they care? They don't care if people are suffering and starving and being poisoned and getting sick. And in fact, that helps the medical industry as well.
So you're okay. Before we go to what should we do, let's talk for just a little bit longer about. People in the United States seem to believe, or at least the politicians seem to believe, that capitalism is the best and only in the most wonderful way. And if you criticize capitalism, then you'll be drowned out by chants of USA, USA. And so isn't it also true that capitalism has created lots of bounteous goodies for those who are on the inside of the gated fence?
Oh, sure, yeah. I mean, now that it exists and it's dominating our whole society, it's certainly more pleasant to be one of the ones being bribed to support it. And the rewards are pretty good. Politicians, they get paid very well for saying those things and for promoting those things and for pushing capitalist interests. That's their job. And if they didn't do it, they wouldn't be in office. I mean, we can be sure that they would be unelected very quickly. We get perks in the United States, too, from imperialism. In some sense, you know, there's a large middle class here, or there was anyway, up until the financial crisis of 2008. But that's where it came from, basically, is the money flowing in through exploitation when production has been offshored. You know, money flows in and is able to pay for a middle class to form.
So, what shall be done?
Well, we can't reform it. We can't ask it nicely to go away. We can't ask it to change. We can't hope that it will change on its own. I think the only way to end capitalism is to overthrow it. And that means for the people who produce surplus value, workers, to take the means of production and put them in the hands of society as a whole. And this requires taking power as well, for the people to, led by the working class, to take power away from the capitalists to define and dominate society. And that's really the only way to lay the basis for a society that we can actually organized in such a way that takes care of everyone's needs and is sustainable. We have to take it out of the hands of capitalists.
I remember years ago hearing Wes Jackson say that Walmart was what was keeping the United States from having a revolution because people can buy cheap consumables there. So how, given the fact that one has to pay one's rent, and given the fact that so many people are so thoroughly metabolized into the system, I mean, how do you get people to, I can see for the very, very poor why they would rebel against the system that is literally killing them, as in the communities where you were just talking about in Bangladesh. But what about, how do we get people who are the material beneficiaries, the people who, in the United States, who are probably listening to this, how do we get them to reject a system that brings them material benefits at the cost of the entire planet and the cost of misery everywhere, when they themselves have to pay their rent? And this is something I face with my work all the time.
Well, I think the material benefits are kind of getting dubious, and the question more is the paying the rent part, you know, that people they have this choice whether they're going to go to work in the morning. They have to pay their rent, they have to buy food, they have to take care of their kids, and so they go to work in the morning. And I don't think I think with the economic crisis, it's shifting from feeling like we have something to defend to we can't fight back because we depend on this economy and we need this job. So that's to me the biggest obstacle right there, is the dependency issue. And
it reminds me of a line by Kropotkin. Kropotkin said he said it better than this, but basically that many revolutions have foundered because of bread.
Yeah.
And the notion
is
that you can have all these great ideas and you can talk about this wonderful new society, but the fact is if you don't have food for 60 days, you die.
Right. Yeah. So an alternative has to be there for people, which I think can only be built through struggle itself. And the first step is acknowledging the problem, understanding the problem, and finding ways to organize. And that, I know that we can't jump from what we have today to a revolution tomorrow, because the population of the United States is very ideologically and politically dominated. There's a very low level of consciousness about the nature of the system and what it might take to transform society. So I think that by sounding the alarm and writing about it and talking about it and trying to organize around it, that's the approach that we can take right now, because we're very weak. We can't overthrow capitalism tomorrow. Even though we face a very urgent situation with climate change, we can't accelerate the process with what we don't have. So that's why I think anybody who does understand this needs to be focused on organizing people and raising consciousness among people, you know, just finding ways to explain what is the true nature of the cause of all this misery and all these problems, and building organizations, building our strength. You know, capital is very organized. It's so organized, they run everything, and most people have no ability to organize anything. So we have to flip that around so that we are able to organize everything and offer an alternative to capitalism. It's the only way we can offer an alternative.
Well, I'm thinking three things. One of them is that part of the Irish struggle against the British the Irish struggle for independence against the British was like the Gaelic literature revival, where they revived their own language, and also setting up alternative court systems and alternative systems of justice to replace, to make it so they were not dependent on the British. And the mm-hmm. I hate using the word patriots, but the U.S. patriots, pre-revolutionary, the Revolutionary War United States people is what I'm trying to say,
mm-hmm.
they set up their own court system too, in parallel to the British system, and mm-hmm. that's part, it seems, of a necessary process. So we not only have to take them down, but we also have to build up the alternatives. And that makes me think of the third thing. And you and I have talked about this before, about people recognize that, you know, the police are important enforcers of the status quo, but a lot of times if you talk to poor communities that are filled with a lot of non-capitalist violence, you know, a lot of, say, gang violence or whatever, that you can't remove the police from those communities because the police are also protecting them. And so one of the keys would be to provide neighborhood, and the Black Panthers understood this, to provide, and the Spanish anarchists understood this, to provide community protection before you can get rid of the police. You can't get rid of the police and just leave a vacuum.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
It's seeming that that's the case, and that's the case. That's one reason. I know this is a very, very small thing, but that's one reason I'm really in favor of community-supported agriculture. Because that helps set up the alternatives so that no matter how the system comes down, whether it's through peak oil or economic collapse or ecological collapse, that people have the alternatives in place.
Yeah.
Or revolution.
I think you're right. I mean, I think that part of being able to defeat the system that exists is offering those alternatives on the political level, the court system, the police enforcement, or, you know, however you would want to call it, neighborhood defense would probably be called, or something like that, as well as in the productive level, you know, being able to feed ourselves and take care of our needs. But I don't, the problem I see with focusing on those things is that you can't really build up a new society within the old only, I think it's a component, but without that emphasis on actually politically defeating them, and by that I mean through revolution, not through elections or anything like that, but actually it dominating them in turn, you know, through force, then they'll just simply crush any alternatives that start to appear. So part of that building alternatives have to be defending them and also being aggressively assertive about them.
Yeah,
but not beyond your capacity, you know. You can't just go out there and start saying, well, we're going to have a new court system now. You have to be able to defend it. You have to be strong enough and well organized.
Well, I completely agree, and that's a problem I have with a lot of the people who say, oh, if you just build an alternative, the old one will shrivel up before your eyes. It's just that's simply not true and doesn't happen.
No, I mean, there have been alternatives everywhere. There are alternatives now that are being attacked and killed and wiped off the face of the earth because they're alternatives.
Yes. So a word you've said many times is organize, and you've done organizing for many, many years. Can you talk about a couple things? One of them is, so what if I'm really loving everything you're saying, but I don't really know, I mean, the word organizing is so big and so scary, I don't know what it means. So can you talk about what it means to organize? I mean, what does one do? And can you also talk about some of the challenges that organizers would face? And I mean, not just the challenges, but also the joys of it. Can you talk about organizing a little bit?
Sure. In fact, this came up recently with someone I was talking to who said, yeah, organize is a great idea, but how? You know, I don't even know what to say to people. I don't know what to do with them. Even if I have a few people who are interested, what do we do? So I think this is a very common problem because, and a common question, because the generation that is young now and apt to organize don't have an organic connection to any kind of mass movement that's ever existed. You know, there's been this generation break from the 1960s to now where the people who are active now did not witness that. So they don't have any models that they can continue, or there's no continuity in organizations. Those organizations have all either disappeared or become irrelevant. So they have to start from scratch, and that's very difficult. And organizing basically means it entails people coming together for a common purpose. And it has to be done in real life and face-to-face. It can't be just, like a lot of people think, if they just put a Facebook page up and get a bunch of people to like it or participate in it, that's organizing. That's good, and it helps, but it's not organizing. Organizing, you have to do it, you have to collect people, like through leafleting, or you can find them at events, find out what they say online, and then ask to meet them, and work together building your organizational structure. So you hold events, domes, talks, protests, whatever. As long as whatever those things are, you're gathering people closer to you and involving them in the building of the organization itself. So it's always getting bigger, and you're always helping people to become more experienced. They're learning how to run things. These are going to be the embryo of a future power center.
So
you
just
know,
a second.
We're talking about.
Hmm? So setting up. So part of the point of doing a protest or an open mic or just anything that you might be going to do, part of the point is to simply get practice at doing it, as well as the actual attempting to stop this bad thing.
Exactly. It's to offer that alternative, to build our own strength. Like, if you imagine if you had 10 people now who said, okay, we agree with your idea of having an alternative court system. Will they be able to pull it off without having worked together, without having actually tried to do anything together that or be effective in the world together? No, they probably would just be, like, flaky and disappear and not show up, and you don't even know.
And nobody would be. And nobody would expect for somebody who has never picked up a basketball before to be able to make a shot. What you do is you practice, and that's how you become better. And it would be the same with this. So you couldn't expect somebody who's never done anything. I mean, you're going to do it, and then you're going to do a terrible job, and then mm-hmm. next time you do a slightly better job, and then eventually you do a pretty good job, right?
Exactly, yes. And you're at the same time helping other people build up their capacity as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, so that's what organizing is. It's all it is face-to-face interactions and working on stuff together and building people for the purpose of defeating capitalism. So you're doing that ideological work, you're building political unity, and you're building organizational capacity. So your activities can't just be anything. I mean, organizing a craft night is not going to get you any closer to defeating capitalism, but if you're organizing people to do activities that are targeting capital in some way, ideologically, politically, or whatever, then you're building an organization that could become an embryo of a new power, a people's power.
And targeting capitalism is really a large-scale thing. I mean, so when you do organizing, it's not merely at the most large scale. You also oppose or work for some specific projects. Like, you've talked to me about a nuclear plant and also about, what was it, a stadium name or something? Those are some actions you've done lately?
Well, those are things that people around here have done, and what we do, what I do when I approach a struggle like that, and what the group I work with, One Struggle, does also, One Struggle is anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist. we will try to relate to different things that are going on about specific things and bring to it, instead of just getting involved and sucked into these struggles against what are actually effects of capitalism, we go and talk to people about why they're happening. You know, what is the cause of this thing happening? So bringing that consciousness to those places and then trying to organize on that basis. So I wouldn't immerse myself in specific short-term goals around what the effects of capitalism are, the evil things it's doing. I would instead find a way to work on those and integrate it into a larger movement against the system as a whole.
Okay, that makes sense. What I was trying to get at with that was just, once again, it's still like when you say we're gonna organize against capitalism, that still sounds really kind of big and scary to me, like when you just say organizing. But when you tell me how to organize, then it's like, well, that's not much different than organizing a dinner, except now you're not organizing a dinner, you're organizing, you know, a protest. But it's still, I can get a feel for it. And it's so you relate the other struggles to the larger struggle. That's one of your niches.
Right, because otherwise you end up just being issue-oriented and targeting the effect, like you might be shooting out the tires of a car instead of cracking the engine block. You know, you're not targeting the actual problem. You're only targeting the effects of that problem or the peripheral, you know, catastrophes being caused by the core problem. So, yeah, integrating those things together and figuring out ways to bring that consciousness to those struggles, that this is part of an overall system that we need to change completely, and not just this little thing here, this little thing here, this little thing there, because that won't stop it. You can stop the Keystone XL pipeline, and behind your back, they've built a railroad system to transport even more oil than that. So you have to look at the entire thing, because still, if you block the capital flow in one area, it'll go around you or it'll go through you. But it won't stop unless you stop it from the heart.
So we have probably about 5 minutes or so left. Can you talk very briefly about the some of the struggles, some of the difficulties that organizers will encounter? Just give your experience on, you know, what they can expect and how they can overcome it. And then also I'd like for you to mention you've got two books out coming this fall, and just mention those.
Oh, thanks. The difficulties are many. We can't expect it to be easy at all, and if you expect it to be easy, you'll be really disappointed and probably quit. You need a lot of persistence and patience, because especially with the low level of political consciousness overall and the high level of ideological domination, you have a lot of people who really don't understand the necessity, and so they might be attracted for a little while, they'll come and go, they'll not really make it a priority. So, but it's still necessary to work with a lot of people like that, because this is who is there, you know. So, and it takes a lot of work to break that ideological domination. So, a lot of struggle. So, I think just total persistence and patience are required, and hard work and focus. So, I guess that's the biggest challenge. And then, of course, once you actually start to be effective, then you get the challenge of having to deal with a very vicious police state that is right there ready to crush you as soon as you become effective. So that challenge is also there, which Occupy faced. You know, as soon as Occupy became, started to become an actual social force, they sent in, you know, they had the conversation between the mayors of the major cities with the FBI and Homeland Security, and they wiped them off the parks and crushed it. And then the other half of them was, the other half of the ruling class was out there trying to co-opt it. So you had them coming at it from both directions. So you have to be aware of those things and prepared for those things to happen. Co-optation is a big one. We have a lot of sincere progressive people who are offered jobs at NGOs, and they get sucked into basically social work instead of organizing people to fight for their livelihoods and for their rights. They become basically consumers of charity instead. So that's one way that the system co-opts people and channels them into different directions. Telling people that the Republicans are so evil that you have to vote Democrat, that's another way. That's another part of ideological domination that we have to be able to help people overcome. So the books, did you want me to talk about them, or are you going to talk about them?
No, I think you should talk about them. I've got like 2 minutes.
Okay. Well, I have one coming out through Seven Stories Press. It's called The Minimum Security Chronicles, Resistance to Ecocide. And it's a graphic novel that sort of goes through a scenario of how a group of friends try to stop a geoengineering project and what works and what doesn't. And the other book is called Capitalism Must Die, and that's going to probably also come out this fall. And it's an illustrated with cartoons text on what capitalism is and how we can stop it. Sort of like what we were just talking about, but in an expanded and more organized form with cartoons.
So is there anything you'd like to leave the listeners with?
If you are interested in organizing at the anti-capitalist, anti-imperialist level, we have an organization like that called One Struggle. It's at onestruggle.net. And if you don't want to join One Struggle and want to form your own organization, but you want to talk with us and learn from our experience, then we welcome your communication.
Okay, well, thank you so much. And I would like to thank listeners for listening to Resistance Radio on Progressive Radio Network. Thank you, Stephanie.
Thank you, Derek. It was a pleasure to be talking with you.